Nicole.
Please be seated. Derek Michael Lawler, I beg your pardon, and His Majesty the King. Appearing for the appellant, Mr. Lawyer John Rosen and Amy Oler. Appearing for His Majesty the King, Benita Wassenaar. Mr. Rosen, whenever you're ready, please.
May it please the court, as you know from the material filed, this is an appeal as of right based on the dissent of Justice Nordheimer in the Ontario Court of Appeal. It is the position of the appellant that the appeal should be allowed simply for the reasons set out by Justice Nordheimer.
Can I stop you right there, Mr. Rosen? You do say so at paragraph 14 of your factum, that you're relying on the analysis and conclusions set out in the dissenting reasons. I'd like you to take you to paragraph 116 of the dissent.
Yes.
And if you could just help explain to me the relevance of this comment to your the position you're taking before us. So Justice Nordheimer starts his dissent after having said that he read the reasons of his colleague and disagrees with her conclusions in respect of the instructions to the jury. He says in the third sentence, in my view, the trial judge's errors in two respects, and here are the words I'm stumbling over, cumulatively, if not separately, did not provide the jury with the necessary instructions to render a safe verdict.
Right.
So I'm wondering what that means to you in respect of the position you're taking.
It means that there are two grounds of appeal. The first is the failure whatsoever to mention the mental upset, and the second is the failure to provide the limiting instruction.
Of course I know that, Mr. Rosen, that there are two. No, but I'm wondering what cumulatively, if not separately, means to your position.
Yes.
So we have two arguments,
right,
and they're to be taken cumulatively, if not separately. What does that mean to you? Does that mean you need to make out both of your, because that you say you're adopting his analysis
and
conclusions.
No. What he's saying is that I could allow the appeal on either one or both. In other words, depending on how you read it. But this is language that's very common in the Court of Appeal. And so what it means is that we could allow the appeal on the first ground, we could allow the appeal on the second ground, or if you look at them, at both of them, for sure it's an unsafe. Okay, so if there's any question about the strength of one or the other, then you look at them together. I'm not saying that I have to prove both. I'm saying that, as a matter of fact, that the issue of the failure to mention the mental health is the strongest. The other one, the limiting instruction, would follow along, and Ms. Oler will deal with that, although it is an important one.
Thank you. Great.
Okay. So, so as I said, and the other point that I wanted to make is that if you read my friend's factum, she makes no reference to where there's an error in this dissent. As a matter of fact, what she tries to do in her response to us is to show that the majority was correct, but she doesn't say that Justice Nordheimer was wrong. And my point to you is this. The dissent written by Justice Nordheimer came out on September the 15th, 2022. And that was before the case of Abdullah High. And he was drawing from all the laws that then stood. We filed our factum on May the 24th, 2023, which was before the decision in Abdullah High came out. Then Abdullah High comes out on July the 14th, 2023, from this court, and sets out all the way you handle this sort of a complaint. And I say, when you then read Justice Nordheimer's decision, through the lens of Abdul-Hai, it's even more correct than it was back when he wrote it in 2015. He did exactly the analysis that was required, whereas the Court of Appeal, the majority, conflated the proviso with the analysis.
Just comment en passant. Having some familiarity with the reasons of the court in Abdul-Hai, I wouldn't myself understand it to really have changed the law, but rather have to given an explanation as to how the body of law that is established is to be given practical effect.
Yes, clearly. But it also sort of sets out a methodology of approach and a warning not to conflate the proviso with the analysis, which is my submission what the majority did. So, because of time, I just wanted to say, look, the charge in every murder case on intent and planning.
In fairness to the majority, Mr. Rosen, in fairness, the majority found no errors, so they didn't need to go to the proviso.
I understand. But what I'm saying is, in their analysis, by relying on what they relied on, they essentially went to the proviso without saying so. That's my point. They did, as Justice Roe pointed out in Abdul-Hai, that they conflated. They didn't keep them separate. So it's our position that, look, in a murder case, the instruction on intent and in a first-degree case on planning and deliberation are mandatory instructions. And it isn't just an instruction on the law. It's an instruction on the law, the elements, and relating it to the pertinent evidence that applies to that. And the second point is that in dealing with mental upset, much like in dealing with intoxication, there isn't an onus on the defense to prove it. The onus is on the Crown to prove the requisite intent or the planning and deliberation, that is the cool weighing and so forth, to prove that, notwithstanding the evidence of either mental upset, alcohol consumption, or both in some cases, as in this case. All right, but the way the majority treated it was that they essentially put an onus. They said, "Well, it isn't good enough. You didn't call an expert. It didn't. It's sort of light and flimsy, and it doesn't really prove the point." Well, then you're requiring the accused to prove it, as opposed to the Crown proving beyond a reasonable doubt in light of this evidence. But more importantly. Oh, and the trial judge specifically told the jury that it was his duty to review the important parts of the evidence and to relate it to the issues that you decide, and that's correct. So he starts off by telling them that, and in this particular case, the Crown called all the evidence. The Crown called the evidence of the mental health history.
So what's the role of defense counsel then? When you're at the pre-hearing or the pre-charge hearing, looking through what the charge is and you notice that this part is lacking?
Well, normally, I guess it depends on the counsel. Look, the defense counsel ought to have raised it. It's clear. I would submit to you. In terms of what they do or don't want in the charge. Speaking for myself, when I do a pre-charge hearing, I come with a menu of items that I want to see in the charge. The problem in this case, and Ms. Oler will address it when she deals with her point, is that this trial judge essentially wrote the charge, handed it out, and asked for comments. And when he got comments that he didn't like, he pushed back.
Well, I have to say, that's not abnormal. I've done pre-charge hearings, and some of us tend to draft, get input, and then go back to the writing table. That's not abnormal.
No, but in this particular case, if you read the record, the trial judge said when he got pushback on some of the items, I mean, he ultimately took out the limiting instruction on the post-defense conduct, for example, because he got pushback from the defense. So what happens then in the context of the trial is that counsel is reactive to the trial judge. And Other counsel may very well have said, no, no, you have to put this in, and I agree that it's not there, but that's not fatal in the analysis.
Your friend argues, drawing on, you mentioned Abdullahi, but it's a long-standing idea that one gives a functional reading to the charge as a whole, and your colleague looks at the charge of the whole, observes the repeated number of times at different moments in the charge that the judge urged the jury to consider all of the evidence, and that in different points of the charge, you're right to say there may have not have been a direct linkage between specific, let's call it mental health evidence, as you do, to intent or planned and deliberate in the way that you might have liked, but there was in the charge reference to that evidence.
No, there wasn't, with respect.
Yes, there was. Page 86 of the charge.
Sorry?
Page 86 of the charge, when he's summarizing your and the defense and the Crown's, I may be mistaken in my reading, you'll correct me, their position. So this is not just submissions of counsel that supplement the charge, but this is in the charge itself.
Great.
There's a reference to Derek Lawler's statement to the police, which was the April 15th statement, which had mental health, psychiatric information in it. Next sentence, he was a patient in the psychiatric ward of the hospital at the time. A little further down on that same page, it is the position of the defense that Derek Lawler's psychiatric condition and his consumption of alcohol and prescription drugs are all factors to be considered in determining whether the Crown has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Derek Lawler had an intent for murder. So it's wrong to say, or is it? Perhaps I'm mistaken in my reading, that he didn't say anything about it. He mentions it there. He mentions the April 15 report earlier. He mentions amnesia, the memory problems in the charge.
No.
It's just that he doesn't link them specifically to the evidence given. And part of what your colleague says, and I guess at least speaking for myself, I need to hear you on this, mm-hmm. that the judge was in a tough spot given the arguments made by defense as to at trial, that the argument of identity, the argument of accident, for example, which were the first two grounds advanced before you got to state of mind, because the psychiatric evidence was wrapped up in inculpatory evidence on identity, wrapped up in inculpatory evidence that would suggest that none of this was an accident. In fact, he had tried something similar with Mr. Davies before. It didn't work out. So that the trial judge was sort of saying to himself, and this is all in Appendix A of the Crown's factum, It was saying to himself, geez, you know, if I put it all on the table, I may be undermining a fair trial for the defense. Is that what's your answer?
My answer to that is that's not what happened. With the greatest of respect, that's not what happened, because there was another story to tell. There was a story to tell about a man who had a 12-year history of mental upset, who had tried suicide, who was abusing drugs and alcohol, who had numerous hospitalizations, who on the day in question was unsure of himself. He was under stresses. He was going to lose his house. He had been fired from his job. He was worried about his insurance. He turned to drugs and alcohol and tried to resist the urge to go into the park. And when he went into the park, he didn't go hunting. He went into the park to a man that he knew, who invited him to participate in three-way a sexual encounter. And the thing around his neck was an erotic experience, not an attempt to kill somebody. And he says in his statement later to the police that I do the same thing to the other guy, and I went too far. And nobody can consent to, you can consent to an erotic strangulation, but you can't consent to dying. And that's what makes it the unlawful act. And therefore, it's at least manslaughter. And that's how what the analysis was. And there's no such thing as an accident in this case that led to an acquittal. And none of that was put to the jury.
It's funny. It's some of the facts that you're giving us, I did not take them the same way. Like, for example, in the park, mm-hmm. I understood that it was the appellant who appeared and asked to join the two others.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. He appeared, and because he saw Mr. Davey, who he knew from before, and asked if he could participate.
Oh, he asked, because I may have misheard you. I thought you said something different.
No, he asked to participate. And what did he do when he was there? He participated in sexual conduct, including an erotic asphyxiation on Davey, who easily took it off and said, "What the hell are you doing?" And then he's left alone with the other fellow. Now, I mean, the question is, in that situation, when you paint it that way, and that's what the evidence at least would support, I'm not asking you to weigh it or anything like that. There is another position to put. But when you look at what this trial judge did, he focused on the park, he focused on the admissions that he was there, he focused on the fact that he was admitting, "I'm out hunting," and my friend says, "Well, he said he was going to do it, he went and did it, and afterwards he bragged about it." But no, there's more to the story than that. And at the hospital he says, "I have blackouts, I have a history of blackouts, I don't remember everything, right? And I'm not sure what happened, and I need you to tell me what happened." That's a different picture, and none of that came through in this case. None.
Well, none?
None. It came through when defense counsel
page
was
48 of the charge. Mm-hmm. Like, none. This is just like, it's a big word, and it's the kind of language that we see. Sorry, 49. Mm-hmm. Reference to Derek Lawler said he was having memory gaps.
In what context, though? That's my point.
Well, in the context of the audio recorded statement mm-hmm. that was before the jury. Like, the judge is describing the evidence that he went to the hospital to get help, that he spoke of false memories and fragments. It's not, there was not none. You just don't overstate it. It's in fairness to the trial judge, you may be right at the end of the day, but overstating your case isn't going to.
But with respect, you pointed out that reference. You have to begin at page 46 of the transcript, page 69 of the, it's a tab two of our concise thing. Record that when he gets to this issue, at this page, it says 69 big letters at the top, it says he's dealing with consumption of alcohol. He says amnesia does not mean that a person is incapable of informing intent, because he talked about, in that paragraph at line 12, consumption of drugs and alcohol and intoxication, and amnesia doesn't mean you can't form the intent. And then he talks about consumption of alcohol, and he goes on to drinking beer and clonazepam, and he talks about Dr. Edgecombe and harboring the thoughts, and about drinking from a plastic cup and so forth. And then you can take into the consideration at page 50 the consumption of alcohol. What you pointed out, Justice Kassir, has to do with his charge on intoxication, not on mental health, in terms of gaps. And so what I say is that when you then go to the reasoning of Justice Nordheimer, and he talks about that, he summarizes the evidence, pages 120 to 124, and he says that there were serious issues with the mental state around the time of the homicide. None of the evidence was mentioned by the trial judge in that context, in the context of mental health. And he goes on at 128 and he says that there was considerable evidence before the jury of the appellant's mental health and the perilous state it was in at the time of the homicide. He did not do so, notwithstanding the evidence was more significant. than the evidence of alcohol consumption, and it went to a critical issue. And he said, and then he goes on to say, it's not sufficient to say that the evidence was before the jury. So all the, you look at the whole of the evidence and all that sort of thing, and he explains it. He says the jury had to follow the judge's instructions. And when a judge doesn't mention an entire body of evidence and just dances around it, in my respectful submission, he's quite right when he says there's every prospect that the jury would conclude that the mental health evidence was not relevant. Because it's the way they view the evidence. It isn't just look at it all. It's the prism through which they view it. What was the trial judge underlining? Oh, the admissions about hunting, the admissions about doing it, about being in the park, about having blood in his hands. All that got mentioned. But all the whole history, none of it got mentioned.
Well, for example, that he was suicidal, that was mentioned.
Sorry?
That he was suicidal, that Ms. Cebulski, the counselor, testified. It's the none of. It's the problem being, and you may be right that it's not a fatal problem, but the problem being, if the judge went down the road of saying, for example, everything that Ms. Cebulski said, he would have gone into inculpatory evidence that would have, that, right. You know, that he was going to Victoria Park with an urge to hurt or kill people, that he had gloves, duct tape, knife in a bag.
Yeah.
So the judge, as I say, it was wrapped up. This was all wrapped up in a ball.
Yes.
And defense counsel, not objecting to the charge, was advancing the identity, the argument.
And the mental health and lack of
intent. And the accident charge.
And the accident. Right?
So
but to answer your question.
Okay.
If I may, because we're running out of time, if I may, to answer your question. All of the things you mentioned about carrying the kill kit, about hunting in the park, about blood on the hands, everything that my friend puts in her chart, every single item was actually mentioned expressly by the trial judge in the charge in any event. So then what more could the trial judge have added that would have hurt the appellant if he had reviewed the evidence of mental health? Nothing. Because he's already pointed out all this evidence of bad stuff that's part of the ball of wax. He's already gone there. So why carve off something that stands in the way to proof of intent, or more importantly, of deliberation, or both, rather. I shouldn't say more importantly, both. All right? And that's what I just don't understand why this all of a sudden becomes, a fair charge. I mean, there's, if you look at the actual evidence that was reviewed by the trial judge, 90% of it is all bad stuff for the Crown, 99% of it. There's nothing here saying, oh, by the way, there's another picture over here. Till he gets to the reviewing the defense counsel's position. But that, in my respectful submission, is not what the trial judge is supposed to do. Trial judge is supposed to say, I've got this whole batch of evidence that the Crown led about this man's mental state. I have to do something with it. I have to alert the jury to it and to tell them, look, when you come to consider intent, the Crown has the onus of proof, notwithstanding the consumption of alcohol, the evidence of mental upset, or both in combination, and any other of the evidence that you take as to whether they've proved it. And when it comes to the planning, there's evidence, you know, about the plan, but deliberation, that at that moment, did he stand there in the park and deliberate, should I or shouldn't I go ahead and commit a first-degree murder when he's in this terrible state? With the greatest of respect, I just, you know, maybe Ms. I'm not going to say that Justice Nordheimer went too far, but certainly when you look at that and you read the, his critique of the majority about weighing the evidence, whether it's limited and you didn't call an expert and all that sort of thing, when the law is you don't have to on that issue. And when they say, well, they're the considered deliberate decision not to to withhold it, to what benefit? None. And to go on and say, well, the failure to ask for the instruction, yeah, sure, it's a factor. But it's not, but as this court has pointed out numerous times, it's still up to the trial judge to do a proper job. I'm going to give way to my friend if I could give her the last 5 minutes, subject to any questions you have.
Good morning, Justices. If I could just pick up on one additional point my colleague did not explicitly state, but I think is implicit in his submissions. The mental health evidence was relevant to the jury's consideration of whether or not the appellant's statements relied on by the Crown as evidence in planning and deliberation were credible and reliable. And to that extent, the trial judge had an obligation to properly instruct the jury on how they were to evaluate those statements in the context of his mental breakdown. So I supplement my friend's, my colleague's submissions on that point. To the extent that the jury convicted him of first-degree murder on the basis of statements made while in that perilous mental condition, the trial judge also erred. I'm going to address you very briefly on the appellant's after-the-fact conduct. The first draft of the charge included an instruction on after-the-fact conduct that, but for two problems, was correct. First, the instruction did not include any reference to the jury to consider alternate inferences available from the after-the-fact conduct. And secondly, it did not properly state the evidence at trial. The evidence at trial was that on the morning after the encounter in the park, the appellant visited news websites. But the trial judge instructed the jury that the appellant was, quote, searching for breaking news or reports about the finding of a dead body in the park. So faced with that draft instruction, defense counsel quite properly objected and spent time explaining to the trial judge how he's overstated the evidence. I've included in the appellant's condensed book, I won't take you to it directly, but at tab 4 is defense counsel's first crack at convincing the trial judge. He's just misstated the evidence. The evidence isn't as strong as the trial judge had first drafted. They adjourn early that day because defense counsel's unwell, and on the next day, he comes back and he's trying to explain to the trial judge what's wrong with this instruction. And what's wrong with this instruction is that it's overstating what the evidence was. There was no Google searches for a dead body in Victoria Park. He had visited news websites while he waited in the hospital, and then after the body was discovered, watched videos about that discovery. So it was not as strong as the trial judge had properly put it. It's very clear the idea to remove that instruction in its entirety was that of the trial judge. He suggested to the Crown, he says, I haven't put this to defense counsel, but I'm thinking I'm going to take it out entirely and move it to the issue of identity. And the Crown's response is, that's great, no objection. That's exactly how the Crown wants the jury to use it. And the Crown offers the input that, yes, and I have no issue if you identify the alternate inferences available. And that's the end of the discussion on the after-the-fact conduct. In closing submissions, the Crown referenced that body of evidence no less than 5 times, relied on it as evidence of the appellant having been in the park that night, but also used it to discount his statement to the police that he suffered a blackout. To quote the Crown submissions, she said, if you truly did not remember the death of Mark McCready, ask yourself, what brought on Mr. Lawler's sudden interest in local news hours before Mark McCready's body was found? So the inference that the Crown was asking the jury to draw was very clear. This was evidence that the appellant was conscious of having committed an offense, and it could be used to reject his statement to the police and claim of loss of memory.
But that's a credibility matter, not whether or not you can use after-the-fact conduct in relation to intent or planned and deliberation.
But the error in the failure to give the instruction is both. The Crown was entitled to make the pitch. Defense counsel spent a good chunk of his closing arguments making the opposite pitch. The jury had to be instructed before using the Crown's inference. They had to consider and reject the alternative. And they needed to be told that in the context of this case, it had to be limited to that issue. There was no limiting instruction in this case, and the trial judge told the jury under the third question, the question of intent, whether or not that they could use the appellant's conduct before, during, and after the offense. So without the limiting instruction, there's just simply no basis to presume that the jury didn't use it for that issue. Finally, the majority finds that the failure to object was a tactical decision of defense counsel, and with the greatest of respect, there's just no basis for that. To suggest that defense counsel or the appellant somehow benefited from the jury not considering alternate inferences or having that instruction, that evidence limited to that one issue, is just not objectively the case. Thank you. Those are my submissions.
Ms. Wassenaar, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. I appear today for the Crown, and my position on this matter is that the charge properly equipped the jury to decide the case. Just to give you a brief roadmap of my submissions, I will first address the instruction on intent and planning and deliberation. I will then deal with after-the-fact conduct, and then I will just make brief comments on the availability of the proviso before I conclude. On the issue of intent, I'll structure both grounds the same way. I say that the instruction was accurate, sufficient, responsive to the position put forward by defense counsel at trial, and finally that the Court of Appeal did not err. In terms of the accuracy of the instruction on intent and planning and deliberation, I say that this was an accurate instruction because of the repeated instruction to consider all of the evidence. And I appreciate that this is what lawyers and judges see as boilerplate, but that's not how the jury receives such an instruction. And I take some comfort from a recent decision of the Court of Appeal in Etier. It's at tab 2 of my condensed book, considering a similar sufficiency ground. And in that case, the court, this is post-Abdullahi, which is why I also say it's relevant. At paragraph 38, the court said, given the nature of the evidence about the appellant's fear of the victim, the absence of an explicit reference to it did not render the charge deficient in light of the repeated admonitions of the trial judge to consider all of the evidence. And I rely on that here. I've included—
Counsel, can I just stop you? So what is your response to, you heard your colleague's argument with regard to the mental health evidence that's sprinkled here and there throughout the charge, and he says that it seems to be related to the intoxicity issue. What's your view with regard to that?
Certainly, it's always the case on appellate review that more could have been said. The standard is not a perfect charge. I take no issue with the fact that that was relevant evidence. It's relevant to the issue of intent. There could have been included a reference to it, and that would have been appropriate. However, in terms of appellate review, we need to consider what was said here, and that needs to be done in the context of the evidence, the submissions of the counsel, and the record. I would wish to just call the court's attention to one specific aspect. It may have been referred to during my friend's submission, but I do say it's some significance that, and this is at tab 5, that in summarizing the position of defense counsel, the trial judge does specifically refer to this. So this is page 23 of my condensed book at tab 5. It is the position of the defense that Derek Lawler's psychiatric condition and his consumption of alcohol and prescription drugs are all factors to be considered in determining whether the Crown has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Derek Lawler had an intent for murder. So again, I acknowledge that's about the position of defense counsel, but it is a clear reference in the charge. So in combination with the instruction to consider all the evidence, I say was an accurate charge.
So your colleague says that's, because I read him that exact sentence, and he said that that doesn't cut it because it's in the summary of the submissions, and the judge should have brought it to light in respect of the specifics of intention or planned and deliberate, rather than relying upon this and, as you say, the repeated references to the injunctions to the jury to consider all the evidence. So the fact that the trial judge didn't link it to intention and plan and specific is the gravamen of your colleague's position. I think you need to answer that.
Yes, and I do acknowledge that it would have been correct to include it in the instruction on intent. I certainly understand my friend taking no issue in terms of that it is a correct instruction in the law on intent, but it is about the sufficiency of the summary of the evidence. And in an ideal world, there would have been reference to it in that section. However, I do go back to the point that Justice Kasserer, you referenced during my friend's submission, that I do say it's a considered and deliberate choice, in part because the other argument at trial, which is not being emphasized on appeal, was in ID, an accident, and that did have an opportunity to take away, and obviously ID would get Mr. Lawler an acquittal, whereas intent gets him to manslaughter. So that is some significance. But in terms of sufficiency, I do also want to look at the closing, and Abdullahi, as this court has recently stated, suggests on appellate review that the court should consider the evidence, the closing arguments of counsel, and the lack of objection by defense counsel. And then in Abdullahi at paragraph 64, there's a specific reference. This court said, appellate courts have viewed counsel's closing arguments as capable of filling gaps in the judge's review of the evidence. And obviously Abdullahi dealt with an instruction more about the law and an element of the offense. And in this case, we have an issue that relates to the review of the evidence. And I say that's a contingent, what I understand Abdullahi to talk about as a contingent instruction. So turning to my argument that it was sufficient, I am relying on the closing argument of counsel. I won't.
So go ahead.
Sorry. Yes, yeah. The trial judge, though, expounded for the jury what they needed to do with the evidence with respect to alcohol and drug consumption as it related to intent. So at page 44, the trial judge says, an intoxicated state of mind is nonetheless a state of mind. Mild intoxication, he goes on to say, is not an acceptable factor. However, advanced intoxication, which results in impairment of the person's foresight of the consequences of their actions to the point where the person is unable to form the intent for murder, can raise a reasonable doubt. Now you have it. They now have the tools with which to deal with the issue of intoxication. Where are the tools that allow this jury, not legally trained, to deal with the mental health evidence? Bearing in mind, mental health evidence came through from a decision of the Crown to adduce the statement of the accused. That means it's a statement that it might have inculpatory aspects, and certainly did in this case, but it might also have portions of that statement that favor the position of the defense. So that's a bit of an issue here, where the defense is not to instruct the jury. The defense puts its best foot forward, provides a statement of its position to the trial judge. The trial judge usually, without more, repeats it fairly closely. That does not replace an instruction of the trial judge on live defenses and or live issues in the trial. I should say it that way.
Certainly, and in an ideal world, again, there would have been a reference within the intent instruction. In terms of appellate review of the instruction, I am relying on the general instruction to consider all the evidence, the specific reference in the charge to defense position, including psychiatric evidence, or the psychiatric condition and intent. And I'm also relying on the extensive discussion in the closing to fill the gaps, as this court has called it, on the, some of that specific evidence that I acknowledge isn't summarized in the instruction on intent.
So if they're busy closing gaps in the defense submissions, then how can that be correlated with the idea that emerges from the majority opinion that there were strategic reasons why there was a hesitation in expounding on the incriminating aspects of the evidence as to mental health?
Certainly. Perhaps I'll go to that now, because the other aspect of this argument is that there was evidence that was damaging to the defense position, and I say in two respects. One is in relation to ID and accident. I think the court has my point on that. But the other is in relation to intent itself. So I will turn to that. But just before I do, just to summarize the defense closing, he does go on at length about hospital visits, interactions with professionals, discussions with friends, the particular troubles that he had at that time. So I say the general instruction from the judge and then the specifics provided by defense counsel were sort of the best of both worlds for defense, because it allowed defense to sort of control the narrative and highlight what was helpful but not risk some of this damaging evidence that I will get into now. So in terms of some of the specifics on that, I say that this evidence was a bit of a landmine for defense counsel, and therefore for the trial judge who is trying to craft this charge. And at tab 10 of my condensed book, just as one example, in the evidence of Dr. Batonti, it's in one line we're getting both things. At line 25, the Crown asks, what discussions did you have with Mr. Lawler on March the 4th? So this is days before. I spoke with him about his thoughts of a suicidal nature, which is something that Justice Nordheimer said was relevant to intent, and also his thoughts of killing promiscuous gay men. So again, could you have parsed that out in a summary? Of course, but I just say that to show really how interconnected some of this evidence was. And more specifically on the issue of intent, another important point that I wish to emphasize is, had the trial judge included a summary, it would have had to be a balanced summary. And there was a lot of evidence specifically on that issue of his mental state that would have needed to be included if it was to be a balanced charge. And I've included this in my condensed book at tabs 11 on March 3. This is about a month before Dr. L. Batrance, or this is page 73 of my condensed book, described him as reasonable, logical, coherent, insightful. And then going on to page 74 of my compendium, still at tab 11, on April 10, that's the day after the murder, Dr. L. Batrance described him as coherent, able to articulate his thoughts clearly, didn't seem to be under any duress, I don't know if that's a typo, or psychosis or anything like that. He seemed quite logical. The conversation was fairly reasonable and a coherent one. Then turning to the nurse who saw him on April 10, again the day after the murder, Nurse Steves at tab 12 describes him as pleasant, coherent. I found, and this is on the following page, 76, I found him perhaps more in control of the assessment than I was. So again, all of this evidence supported the Crown's position on intent, and I say would have had to be included if it was to be a balanced.
But let's confront that. If you said earlier, in an ideal world, there would have been linked to the summary of the evidence on intent and plan to deliberate, there would have been references to the psychiatric condition. If you say the good would come with the bad, what does a trial judge do? Should the trial judge have said, well, to properly equip the jury, and notwithstanding the position of defense counsel, my duty is to lay the evidence out, and thus, this is my question, did the judge in this case make a mistake in crafting a charge that he thought would thread the needle, but at the end of the day didn't end up working out?
Well, certainly if he did, defense counsel didn't alert the trial judge to that at any point during this extensive pre-charge conference. And if I can get into just a little bit of the specifics of the opportunity to provide input on the charge, because this is significant. At tab 16 of my condensed book, my friend suggested that, you know, the trial judge just provided a draft and that was it, and I take issue with that characterization. At tab 16, we have the trial judge sort of taking an initial, you know, I'm just getting started on this. This seems pretty straightforward. I need to know what's at issue. I'm looking for input from you. And we have there at page 85, the Crown saying, perhaps there may be something raised in the areas of, this is line 15, of mental health or intoxication. So we have the Crown, this is September 27, we have the Crown at the very earliest stage before the trial judge is drafting the charge, flagging both of those issues. Now, defense counsel very much picks up on the issue of intoxication and makes extensive submissions during the pre-charge conference that follows, asking for intoxication to be left. The Crown disagrees, and the trial judge ultimately does leave intoxication. So I think it's important to contextualize, again, that this is flagged by the Crown prior to the draft. A draft is provided over the weekend. We then have 3 days of pre-charge conference. I won't take you to them in my condensed book, but it's heard over the course of 3 days. Extensive opportunity to comment, extensive opportunity to raise any objection. And I do say it's a very difficult position for the trial judge to be in, again, being responsive to all of the defenses that are being relied on at trial.
Can I just stop you there? Looking at Abdullahi, one of the issues was the role of defense counsel, and I'm looking at paragraph 4, and we said in there, the evidence at trial, the closing arguments of counsel, so partly what you're relying on in this case, and the lack of objection to the charge by the defense counsel cannot make up for the error by the trial judge. Isn't that what we have here, where everyone has a role to play, and basically the trial judge just didn't take up his part of the role with regard to how to address the issue of mental health and the intent?
I say no, and again, I turn to a distinction that I see between this case and Abdullahi, and that was about leaving an element of defense, an element of the offense, which is clearly the responsibility of the trial judge. And there's helpful language by Justice Doherty in the Bouchard case saying, you know, some of these contextual aspects are, you know, relevant to sort of those judgment calls that a trial judge is going to be making, but if the judge gets the law wrong, and I understand that that was the court's view in Abdullahi, that's a different story. So I say that distinction between a mandatory and a contingent instruction is really at play here, and it's when you have a contingent instruction like the sufficiency of the review of the evidence that it's more significant.
Yeah, one of the things that the trial judge does when charging the jury is to put up what I'd call signposts. And one of the ways in which it's very important is when you go through the requisite elements of the offense, and you say to the jury, each of these elements of the offense must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt for you to convict. And you say, and here, while you are to take into account all of the evidence, I put to you that here is evidence which is particularly significant, and that I would ask you to turn your mind to when you consider this issue. So that's what I mean by the signposts. And that was really, there's no change that arises from Abdullahi in that. That's, it seems to me, quite foundational. And that is how I understood Mr. Rosen's submissions to be. The trial just didn't put up the signpost when it came time to the requisite intent for first-degree murder, didn't put up the signpost saying, in considering this, have regard to the evidence as to the mental state of the accused, including the following. That's how I understand his argument.
Yes, and again, in an ideal world, there would have been reference to it, but the trial judge is attempting to craft an instruction that's responsive to the submissions of defense counsel. It is included in his summary of the defense position. It is discussed at length in the closing. I say that can fill the gap because this is more of a discretionary aspect. And it's not a case of, oh, you know, defense counsel forgot. The Crown is specifically flagging this issue, and the court or the defense counsel chose to focus on intoxication, didn't ask for that specifically, and again, I say was left with the best of both worlds, sort of controlling the narrative by providing that detail and content to rely on the more general instruction that avoided some of the damaging evidence. And just the final piece of that is that I say it's not apparent that this evidence that I say is, you know, available for consideration, but it's not apparent how this would have, on the ground in a practical way, assisted Mr. Lawler. And I turn to the Court of Appeals reasons. I've excerpted them at tab 25 of my condensed book. So this is page 27 of the judgment, which is 129 of my condensed book. And at paragraph 56, the majority for the Court of Appeal says, in response to questions from the panel on appeal about how the jury ought to have been instructed in this case, the appellant's counsel acknowledged that the evidence could have been stronger and more precise, and that not much could be made of the fact that the appellant had been hospitalized or was taking psychiatric medication. And I say, still, on appeal, it is not apparent how that mental health evidence would, in practice, have undermined the intent.
It could have created a reasonable doubt about intent or planned and deliberation. And when we look at that mental health evidence, it's not just that part of it. The part that's perhaps the most probative, for example, would be that he didn't know that certain things were real in his evidence. So that's not, excuse me, Mr. Rosen, mental upset necessarily in a small way, or a mental health issue in terms of something. It goes to the essence of whether or not he could turn a mind to what he was doing, and whether or not he had the requisite intent at the relevant time.
Certainly, and this might bleed a little bit into the proviso argument, which I do rely on both harmless error and overwhelming case, but we do have, in terms of intent, Mr. Lawler, you know, driving around with gloves and a rope, talking about having thoughts of harming promiscuous gay men, specific reference to
clearly evidence of planning and deliberation. I don't think that there's any problem recognizing that is probative to that. But the actual question is, were the jury members equipped to understand what the intent element was in this context, with the combination of what he claims was disassociational, very extreme mental distress, plus the intoxication, the combination. I know that the rolled up instruction isn't in front of us, but it just seems that by focusing on one of the two rather than both or in combination, they might not be equipped to understand that they're to pull the evidence or to pull the argument together and ask whether or not they have a reasonable doubt about intent.
If I can just make a few comments on the evidence, Mr. Lawler did have some credibility and reliability issues that were acknowledged, and there was no specific diagnosis, and the passage that I read you said, at least for the next day, that there was no dissociation. The Crown also, and I'll get into the after-the-fact conduct, but they used some of the web searches that occurred before the body was found the next day, sort of pushing back on this idea of, you know, was there amnesia? So certainly, you know, these things were talked about. I take no issue that they could be relevant, but I just want to contextualize the evidence a little bit in that there was no specific diagnosis or expert evidence on that, and I say that as part of a contextual analysis.
So if could be relevant is a thought here, then isn't that the job for the jury in weighing the evidence, having it presented in a context that they can use effectively, instructed on the law? Isn't that a weighing exercise?
Certainly, and I say that the jury had enough because they had the specific, again, I don't want to repeat myself, but they had the specific references from defense counsel, the general instruction from the trial judge, and the specific reference that the defense position was the psychiatric condition and intoxication. So I say in these circumstances and given the submissions of defense counsel, that that was sufficient. I don't say it was perfect, but I say it was sufficient, and I say it was responsive to the submissions of counsel during the very extensive pre-charge conference. They essentially have like a week and a half with this, and I say this is quite an exceptional amount of time to provide input. I see my time is running low, so I just will turn briefly to the after-the-fact conduct evidence, which I also, just before I leave that, I say that the majority of the Court of Appeal took a functional approach, and they looked at the evidence, they looked at the submissions, and I say my friend has not pointed to error in the court below. In terms of the after-the-fact conduct evidence, again, I say it was accurate, the charge was accurate, sufficient, responsive, and that the Court of Appeal did not err. In terms of the accuracy, the trial judge placed this, the web search evidence, and Justice Rowe, you talked about signposts, so I say the signposts were very clearly provided in terms of, and this is at tab 27 of my condensed book, the trial judge structured his charge in these four areas. The first was whether the appellant caused the death of Mark McCready. The web search evidence was included in that first part, as can be seen on the next page. And we know from Abdullahi, I won't take you to it, but at paragraph 42, this court said that the organization of the charge and the placement of something within the charge is significant. So, and the judge was quite transparent that this was what he was trying to do, and he was making an effort to address the concerns of defense counsel. I also wish to point out that the evidence was significantly qualified, and this is at tab 28 of my condensed book. On page 146, he notes, in cross-examination, Sergeant Silva said that Derek Lawler's cell phone could have gone to the news websites because the phone had been used to access those sites previously. So that was a very helpful and on the evidence, perhaps an overly helpful qualification of the evidence, but it was arguably an innocent interpretation of that cell phone or website evidence. So again, the charge that, and just to contextualize it a bit, in other cases like Callanan, we're often talking about highly prejudicial evidence, like moving a body, burning a body. We simply don't have that kind of evidence. On the defense reading, someone's just looking on the news on their phone. So it just simply doesn't have that same potential danger. Again, my time is limited, but it's in my condensed book. This issue was addressed. The trial judge's removal of the instruction was in response to a defense submission. Multiple copies of the draft were provided. I've included those. The most significant is at tab 36, which shows the crossed out after the fact conduct instruction. So if there was any lack of clarity on what defense counsel wanted, it certainly was made clear through this process. Also at tab 33, I include the trial judge summarizing the changes that he made and flagging the changes that he made. So he was very transparent about that aspect of the charge, and I say very responsive to defense counsel's position on after-the-fact conduct. Finally, on this point, I say the Court of Appeal below did not err. They looked at the evidence, they looked at the initial charge, they looked at the law and after the fact conduct, and they concluded at paragraph 11 that there was little risk and no misdirection. In my 2 minutes, I just want to address briefly the proviso. Again, I'm arguing both harmless error and an overwhelming case. On the issue of harmless error, Abdullahi says that we can look at counsel's silence, and I say that that is relevant in terms of both of these instructions.
Now, Khan to me is the big case here, and it really kind of says something really simple on my reading of it. It doesn't matter. Like, this error is of a nature, it doesn't matter because it's a trivial or an inconsequential error, or the evidence is so overwhelming on this issue that the error couldn't possibly affect the result. So it's kind of like two extremes. So it's kind of like a, how can I put it? It's common sense in a way. That's what Khan says. This didn't matter, even if there was an error.
And certainly the harmless error argument on the after-the-fact conduct is much stronger, but for both the overwhelming evidence, I place heavy reliance on that. We have someone who said with great specificity what he was going to do, having a rope, having a knife, referring to going to Victoria Park, saying that he had previously considered harming somebody that he was with. We know that Mr. McCready was found, we know that he was strangled, and that he was stabbed. He was found in the area of the park where Mr. Davey had left them, and then afterwards he told people that he had done that. So he says what he's going to do, he does exactly that, and then he says that he did. So in terms of the overwhelming case, that is my submission. And in my 15 seconds left, I just wish to say that the notion of silence of counsel, I say, is nuanced, and really what we have here is a continuum that shows a high degree of consideration of counsel's position.
Ms. Wassenaar, may I ask one last question? It was pointed out that the Court of Appeals judgment was rendered prior to Abdullahi. You cite Abdullahi in argument, as does your friend. Your friend actually suggested that the majority opinion may have conflated the proviso and the no error dimensions of the case. My question to you is, first, was there errors of this order in the majority opinion of the Court of Appeal? You've said earlier, well, in an ideal world, it might have been done differently. Was there something less than ideal in the majority opinion in the Court of Appeal, in your view? And is it consonant, notwithstanding the fact that it was decided before Abdullahi, consonant with the direction that this court has given to appellate court review of jury charges in that case?
I say that there was no error and that the reasons are, as Justice Rowe has said, Abdullahi really does, you know, summarize the law and doesn't fundamentally change many of the considerations that we rely on, and that the Court of Appeal took a functional approach, and that is what Abdullahi, as I understand it, emphasizes in terms of looking at the evidence, looking at the positions of counsel. And the Court of Appeal very much did that in this case. So I see no inconsistency with Abdullahi. And I just, my second point on that is just again that Abdullahi was about an instruction on the law and whether an element of the offense was understood. This is about the sufficiency of the evidence, and I understand that to be what Abdullahi would call a contingent instruction. And when we're talking about a contingent instruction, that's when the context of the evidence, the positions of counsel, the opportunity to shape the charge, the opportunity to object is really important, and that the court's emphasis on that contextual analysis is consistent with what this court has said subsequently in Abdullahi.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wassenaar. Mr. Rosen, in reply.
In response to what my friend has said, you cannot separate the the charge on, or the explanation of the law and the relating to the pertinent evidence, and say one is mandatory and one is contingent. In my respectful submission, they both go together. They're both mandatory in a murder case. Secondly, there's a difference between having a void of instruction versus gaps. And counsel, in this case, counsel's comments couldn't possibly stand for what the trial judge said. Thirdly, it wasn't as if the trial judge was not alive to the fact or somebody brought it to his attention. My friend correctly pointed out it was the Crown who said, oh, and there's the mental health evidence that you have to charge on, and the trial judge didn't say anything. He didn't turn to the defense counsel and say, oh, do you want me not to do that? No, he didn't do that. He just didn't do it at all. And the other point I wanted to make is that my friend went back to this landmine issue, the damaging evidence and so forth, and she gave you some examples. Well, if you turn to tab 2 of our contents book, which is the instruction on the third element, which is on intent, you will see that at
which page, tab, please? I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Tab 2 of our condensed book. It has to do with the third element, and if you go to the page that it says in larger print 71. It's the PDF 71, but it's page 48 of the actual transcript. You'll see that after dealing with, or in the context of dealing with intoxication and so forth, he ends off with Lynn Steves about alcohol and clozapine, et cetera, and Dr. Edgecombe about motor skill impairment. What he specifically says is, I have previously mentioned the evidence of him telling a number of people that he harbored thoughts of harming promiscuous men. And in the audio statement, he talked about cruising and so forth. So he highlights that evidence, highlights it. And so where's the landmine if you then go through the mental health evidence? He's already put in all of this stuff, and here's a perfect example of where, in the context of alcohol, he highlights it. So what's the harm in doing dealing with mental health?
But can I just ask you this question? By the time the matter came before the Court of Appeal, whether or not Mr. Lawler committed the unlawful killing of Mr. McCready was not in doubt, right? I mean, it was conceded at the Court of Appeal. So the Court of Appeal and us, we have a case that looks a whole lot different than the one that was presented to the trial judge, where identity and whether or not there was an unlawful killing was part and parcel of that. And so it's easier perhaps for us to focus on the intent part now that the unlawful killing aspect is been resolved.
I agree with you in this sense. Counsel ought not to have inconsistent defenses. You can't run it up. I mean, we've known that since the Guy Paul Morin case, when number one, when Mr. Ruby ran. He didn't do it, but if he did it, he was insane, right? And so, and this is the trouble that you get into. But it doesn't relieve the trial judge's obligation to say to counsel, at the very least, okay, are you focused on identity? Is that where your defense is? So I'm not going to leave anything about mental health. I'm not going to talk about intoxication. I'm not going to get into the state of mind. We're going to focus on that. Is that what you want me to do? And that's the duty of the trial judge. And if counsel says, no, I want both, well then, you know, it's a difficult road to hoe, but the trial judge is going to have to do that. All right? Or I mean, there's nothing else you can do. As a counsel, I would never ride two horses, but if you have a counsel in front of you who's doing that, you at least have an obligation to say, which one are you writing, and how do I structure my charge?
Except that when the trial judge is in that sort of situation, in this case, he may, by the time he gets to the intent part, say, all right, if the jury's at intent, they found an unlawful killing, I understand that. But in intent, I will nevertheless not try to undermine the argument about identity by how I craft my charge.
Yes, and in fact, there's a Court of Appeal decision where that happened to me exactly. It was identity, and the trial judge in the middle of the charge turned and said, and now the position of the defense is he didn't do it, but if he did it, he didn't have the intent. Is that right, Mr. Rosen? I stood up and said, no, I'm only here on identity. You may have an obligation to deal with it differently. And Justice Martin said, you're right. The judge was right. That's how you deal with it. But you at least, and here somebody says to him, the trial says mental health, and he doesn't say, turn to the defense and say, what do you say about that? And it's just like, he just ignores it completely, and that's what causes the problem. And then you've got the defense counsel going to the jury and saying, oh, by the way, if he did do it, he was had all this mental health issues that prevented him from the Crown from proving intent or planning deliberation. I mean, he's got that right in the charge, in the addresses. So how can he ignore it in the charge?
Yeah.
Those are my suggestions.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. The court will retire to deliberate. I would ask counsel to remain at our disposal.
Court, la cour.
Please be seated. Court would thank counsel for their able and thoughtful submissions. We have deliberated and we are ready to render our decision. The reasons for the majority will be delivered by Justice Obansowin, the reasons for the minority by Justice Kassira. I would call upon Justice Obansowin, please.
This is an appeal from R versus Lawler, 2022 ONCA 645, in which the majority dismissed an appeal by Derek Lawler of his conviction for first-degree murder by a jury. The majority in the Ontario Court of Appeal dismissed the appeal. Justice Nordheimer would have allowed the appeal and ordered a new trial. Only two grounds of appeal are before this court. The first is whether the trial judge erred in his instructions to the jury regarding the use of evidence as to the accused's mental health and the requisite intent for first-degree murder. The second relates to evidence of after-the-fact conduct. A majority of this court would allow the appeal on the ground relating to the requisite intent for murder and for first-degree murder, but not on the ground relating to after-the-fact conduct. As to the first ground, we are in substantial agreement with the reasons of Justice Nordheimer. As to the second ground, we are in substantial agreement with the reasons of the Ontario Court of Appeal majority. We would add the following comment. As has been stated on many occasions, and we repeat it here, courts need to be mindful of evidence as to the mental health where this is relevant to the issues of criminal responsibility. This is especially so in instructing a jury to assist them in the proper use of such evidence. Accordingly, the appeal is allowed, the conviction is set aside, and a new trial is ordered.
I would dismiss the appeal. I allow myself two observations. First, I agree with my colleagues that courts need to be mindful of mental health evidence in criminal matters, including in instructions to the jury. As the majority in the Court of Appeal wrote, there is no question that evidence of mental health problems may be relevant to issues of intent and planning and deliberation, including in an assessment of the adequacy of a jury charge. See the reasons of the majority in the Court of Appeal, paragraphs 41 and 44 to 48. Second, and with the utmost respect for other views, I conclude that the trial judge's charge properly equipped the jury, in light of all the circumstances, to decide the case according to the exacting standard set forth in R against Abdullahi. In sum, in respect of both mental health, the mental health and the after-the-fact evidence, I see no reviewable errors in the jury charge, and on these points, I would adopt the majority reasons of Van Rensburg J.A. as my own without reserve.
Accordingly, by, as Justice O'Bonsman indicated, by a majority of 4-1, the appeal is allowed, the conviction is set aside, and a new trial is ordered.